A villa assunta.
At 9, Johnny knocks. He will drop them at the town gate, and all morning they can explore San Rocco. He recommends Trattoria Stefano for lunch, and then he will return them to Villa Assunta because of the jet lag. Tomorrow he has suggested a trip to IKEA, near Florence, since they will need supplies for the house, with a stop afterward at his cousin's organic restaurant, Verde. By then, Grazia's mother's Cinquecento will be ready, and they are on their own. Just inside the gate, they marvel at the medieval arch and the vast doors. Julia spots the fresh pasta shop. Let's get some on the way out. Go all the way into town and start at the far point so we don't have to lug everything. That was hard. They want to stop at the Forno, at the gelato shop with the tempting linen store next to it. They pause for cappuccino and meet Violetta, who offers the coffee at her bar. Small streets drop downhill off the main street. They wander in galleries and jewelry shops as wide as an arm span. At the end of the street, they find a cookware store and indulge themselves in a food processor and a good coffee machine with pods. Julia selects 3 spatulas and some ice trays. They don't yet know that Italians think iced drinks cause stomach problems, hence no trays in the home fridge. They buy a steam iron to replace the relic they'd seen in the pantry, and 3 hair dryers.
"Of course I know where you are living," he tells them. "Una bella villa. You honor us with your choice of San Rocco."
The second coffee they take at the smaller Piazza XX Settembre, overlooking the public rose garden and a view of the agricultural valley below. This barista, Paolino, bows as they enter, smiling as though they are long missing cousins. He too offers the coffee.
"What is this?" Camille wonders. "Do they always do this?"
"Bizarre. I imagine it's because of Grazia's family, the house. I don't know, but it's great." Umbrellas are put away for the season. At the outdoor tables, the women turn their faces to the mid-morning sunlight. They forget about exposure and skin cancer and just bask in the warmth, consulting their lists and staring at windows. A balcony still dripping with pink geraniums, shiny paving stones, and people going about their daily lives. They feel they are walk-ons in a play, and, of course, they are. The ongoing drama of life in a small town. Internet images of San Rocco occupied them over the months of planning, but they were in no way prepared for the limpid light bathing the Renaissance facades of ochre, rose, sunflower yellow, and cream. The white marble steps leading up to the piazza's church have over centuries worn to the soft gleam of soap, and the tower bells ringing the quarter hour, the half hour, and the hour gong so resoundingly that their bones reverberate.
"That's the nanny goat bell."
Paolino nods toward the bell tower as he gathers their cups. He's worked on cruise ships for years and speaks English.
"Every church gives a different sound. Santa Catarina, the struck dishpan. San Filippo, the goose honk. Sant'Anselmo, the leper's bell. You know, the lepers had to warn that they were approaching."
Susan is transfixed by Paolino's thick hair, cut close on the sides, with a frothy top that makes her want to say pompadour. It sweeps up and back, a glistening tar-black surfer's wave about to break. Julia thinks the croissant, called a cornetto, is terrible, the dough all wet and wadded in the middle.
Camille imagines a straggling leper ding-a-linging across the piazza, followed by a cavorting goat and a goose. Jet lag. Major jet lag. Paolino waves as they gather their bags.
A domani.
See you tomorrow. I'm going to the bookstore where they sell art supplies. Meet you in an hour on the church steps? Camille has a large tote she intends to fill.
Yes, I'll get groceries, Julia adds, and the bread.
I'm just going to wander around. Susan hoists her bag onto her shoulder. Every street looks tempting. Susan, used to engaging with strangers, introduces herself at Anna and Pietro's Frutta e Verdura. The outrageous display of citrus lured her. How many kinds of tangerines are there? What's that?
Cedro,
huge and rippled. Lemons, some large and bumpy, some small and smooth. What's that?
Bergamota.
The fragrance meets her as she leans over to see the labeled crates. Used in tea, she remembers. Whatever else it is, she thinks, it smells like lemon blossoms and oranges, something I'd like to spray on myself. What a beautiful word, arancia. We must have the blood oranges. Julia will be thrilled. Anna and Pietro pick out prime fruits for her, and Anna describes an insalata. Susan understands that, with oranges and fennel. Anna also gathers a bunch of beets. She looks equivocal, but holds out the three together. Susan buys the beets, too. Usually indifferent to cooking, she wants to carry half the shop home. The enormous funghi porcini, shiny chestnuts, and huge leafy wings of something called gobi.
Dialetto, Anna says, e il cardo.
Well, I'll puzzle through that later, Susan thinks. Anna chooses a cedro as a gift to her. Julia will figure out what to do with it. In the cheese shop, she buys a large wedge of sweet gorgonzola, tiny black olives, and a jar of truffle butter. At first, Camille doesn't see the bookstore owner crouched in the back of the shop. She is reading in a low chair covered in a ragged oriental rug. Signora Bevilacqua unfolds herself and rises. She is both stooped and tall, her hair clipped up in gray loops, and her ivory face gently wrinkled like crepe paper. Her eyes are clear and dark amber. Every Italian word she's memorized flies out of Camille's head, and she's reduced to pointing to the tubes of oil and acrylic paint, the brushes, and rolled linen for canvases. The shop cat twirls around her ankles, then the ankles of the signora, who opens drawers and points to brushes with delicate sable tips, to watercolor sets that cost a fortune, and to rolls of tracing paper. Tape. Pencils, erasers. Tubes of raw sienna, raw umber, burnt sienna, and terra verde, a muddy green for this landscape. A color wheel. Si, Camille agrees over and over. Her bag loaded, she thanks the signora and remembers what Paolino said.
A domani.
See you tomorrow. She runs into Julia, emerging from the grocery store.
Guess what? They deliver. This is the most civilized place. They stock all the local wines, too, and I bought a mixed case. The store is minute, but everything you need is right there. Makes our giant stores at home seem a bit silly. And they were lovely people. There's Cinzia, her husband Quinto, and their son Tommaso.
Julia did not say that Cinzia's oval face and perfectly straight nose reminded her of Lizzie. Momentarily, she had the familiar nightmare feeling
of being trapped in an unmoored bathysphere. Lizzie, dizzy. But Quinto handed her a slice of San Daniele prosciutto, and concentrating on the buttery taste, she righted herself. Early in the day for it, but Susan orders a hazelnut gelato. The girl seems surprised that she only chose one flavor. With a medium, she said, holding up the cone and raising three fingers, you can choose three. Susan smiles and holds up one finger. Down to basics, she thinks, holding up my finger like a one-year-old. I've got to study now. Susan sits on the lip of the fountain, enjoying one of the pleasures she almost always denies herself. A fabulously gorgeous young woman strolls by, wheeling twins, both smiling.
Buongiorno, signora, the young woman calls, as if they were neighbors.
Her life, Susan thinks. Her amazing, beautiful years of life in this place. She catches herself. The woman's life might be horrid. But the dreamy one tosses back her thousand ringlets and steps away, who knows, back into the pages of Vogue. Susan thinks she might cry. 12:15. They are early for San Rocco Trattoria's. Lunch starts at 1. But the door is open at Stefano's. Okay. We're in a film. The waiter is too gorgeous. His shaved head shines like a polished pecan. He sports a soul patch and a pointed, highly styled beard. The fitted gray shirt and tight jeans leave no doubt about his lean and muscular body. He is Stefano, son of Maurizio, whose family flung open the doors 60 years ago and have been cooking pasta and mixed grill ever since. Stefano, 30, insists on new ideas. Not just traditional Tuscan food, but innovations too, especially on the dessert list, which previously had been only panna cotta, tiramisu, which he loathes as an American invention, and creme caramel. Now there are seasonal fruit roulade, vin santo cake, and in autumn, fig and walnut tarts. Maurizio is fine with this, as he's overheard local expatriates sigh over the same old menu. Chief cook Zia Valentina, Maurizio's sister, feels fiercely partisan toward what her grandmother cooked. Good enough for the family for centuries, good enough for badly dressed tourists. Thus, eruptions of shouting and clattering pans in the kitchen, often causing diners to look at each other in alarm. Today, all's calm. Like everyone, Stefano knows they will live at Villa Assunta. He even knows that one is, or wants to be, an artist, as he has met Signora Bevilacqua in line at the post office. He will hear later this morning of the extravagant purchase of the food processor, a 2-year-old model that Martino was delighted to sell. He suggests the pici, the preferred pasta in San Rocco. Susan wants hers with big garlic, Julia chooses wild boar sauce, and Camille decides on spicy tomato sauce. They love the pici, rolled long and thin like a thick spaghetti. After they decide not to have wine, Stefano brings over a liter anyway, and they surprise themselves by finishing it with their second course, the mixed grill with roasted potatoes. The meats are lean, almost stringy, but richly flavorful. The local bread has a fine texture, but since the cuisine is a salty one, the dough is mixed without salt. This will take some getting used to. They don't want it, but Stefano brings them Mont Blanc, a swoon of a dessert made from pureed chestnuts and whipped cream. Very special, for special guests. Luckily, the fresh pasta shop is still open.
They decided on a long rest followed by an early night with a simple dinner. Susan remembers the tagliatelle and the jar of truffle butter in her bag, but picks up some ravioli as well. Shop owners have locked up and headed home for pranzo. Smells of long simmered sauces and roasts drift from upstairs windows.
I don't want to eat for days, Susan moans.
Just outside the gate, they spot Gianni's van.
How do you like our San Rocco?
He slides open the door and they pile in with their packages.
Paradiso, Julia says.
Ah, no, signora, but maybe close.
What does gobi mean, Gianni? And dialetto? Susan asks.
Hunchback, dialect. You have bought gobi? Is like the artichoke, but more difficult. You could call it cardo.
And why hunchback?
Non lo so. Perhaps because the leaves curve?
Julia gets it. Must be cardoon, the most difficult vegetable on earth. I've never met one in person. As Gianni turns down the drive, the harmonious house fills the windshield. Camille rolls down the window and breathes deeply. She turns and looks at the others in the back seat.
We're home.
As Susan carries into the dining room the bowl of truffle pasta, redolent of loamy woods and parmigiano, she pauses in front of the fresco. It's dark in the garden now, but she noticed earlier the conceit of the house's view reappearing on the wall. The garden foregrounded, rose arches, the two distant volcanoes. She feels a prick of joy. She gets to look at this for many fabulous dinners. I'm going to check all the outbuildings, she thinks. I wonder if those iron arches in the painting might be rusting away somewhere. Camille, bringing in a pitcher of water, joins her.
Isn't this just too much to bear?
She also has spent a half hour looking at the fresco. She found herself smiling the whole time.
There was a big spirit at large here, wielding the brushes.
I wonder if she, surely it was she, was the owner or the daughter. Look at that sharp little bird. The good word, cena. I arrive a few minutes early at Leo and Aneta's for the dinner cooked in honor of the murdered hen. If he's home on time, Colin may join us. He does not like to miss a meal at Casa Bianchi. I'm bringing a pear tart, although I know that Aneta also will serve her apricot or plum crostata. My Italian friends instinctively distrust foreigners' cooking. They're always telling me how to do the simplest things, as though we in America have no idea how to stuff a tomato or chop an onion. When they like something I serve, they express genuine delight and surprise, as if they're witnessing a dog performing a smart trick. As I unburden my tart and wine on the kitchen counter, Aneta and her sister Flavia are setting the table. At one end, they've plopped a tall vase of autumn leaves and rose hips. Usually they don't bother with decoration. This is a special occasion. The chief of the Carabinieri, his wife and baby, have arrived, along with Flavia's husband, Roberto, who remains in the family, although Flavia left him years ago and moved in with her sister and Leo. The hen and rabbit turn slowly in the fireplace, along with skewers of sausages and pork liver. Enter the three women. Camille, Susan, Julia, they say, and I rush to introduce myself. They're flushed from the chilly walk. My first impression? Very American. What is that giveaway that most cultures have? Why don't Americans look Swiss or English or Germans look American? Well, the one with cropped gray hair, Susan, could be French in her bias-cut skirt, stack-heeled boots. Did she walk up the hill in those? And asymmetrical red and gray sweater. She cocks her head slightly, letting me know that she is appraising us. Not in a bad way, just aware. All three look clean. Scrubbed, really, with shiny hair and open faces, all smiling with their great American teeth. Innocence? Is that the dead giveaway for American women? But Margaret never looked innocent. Just as baggy pants are the hallmark of American men. Julia seems a bit shy. She's examining the roasting meats in the fireplace and the coals hissing and popping from drops of fat. She has a questioning look. Camille looks around at everything. Her first Tuscan farmhouse. She compliments Aneta and Leo on the open room with the long table dominating all. I can see your priorities, she laughs. I'll be working double time tonight as interpreter. She admires the casual comfort of six oversized armchairs arranged around a low round table heaped with magazines, books, yarn baskets, and fishing tackle. She says to me, "Hey, Ralph Lauren, heads up." It's true. Plaid blankets, taxidermy owl, an upright piano, mismatched dining chairs. They have brought flowers and wine, and at IKEA today they have found an olive wood cutting board for Leo. Were they subconsciously thinking of him beheading the chicken? He turns it over and over, examining the work. They will learn later that he makes better ones himself, along with carved napkin rings, walking sticks, and birdhouses. Though it's not our local custom, Aneta hands around glasses of Prosecco because this is a special night. Usually we arrive at 8 and sit down with no preliminaries.
Benvenuti, Cin Cin.
So, here they are. 2 days ago, they had their worlds. Now, rashly and happily, they have this new one. Can't everyone envy them? Everything unfolding, everything new and shining. I like them immediately. Aneta, sensitive to the language issue, seats the women together, with me across from them. The men, as usual, are at one end of the table. Out comes the platter of antipasti, salumi olives, crostini, and pecorino. You are in for a major treat, I tell the women. Aneta may be the size of a 10-year-old girl, but she is a mighty cook. Leo asks about Villa Assunta. Are they comfortable? He volunteers to bring over fireplace wood. Aneta notices that they didn't close the shutters at night and tells them they'll be warmer in winter and cooler in summer if the shutters are closed. I rarely close mine and doubt if the women will either, because the rooms become as black as inside a coffin and it's hard to wake up in the gloom. A cultural thing. The baby is extraordinarily large for 6 months. She placidly sucks on a piece of bread. The mother, Margarita, looks wan, exhausted from hauling around such a hefty girl. Eugenio, the carabinieri chief, assures the women that he will do anything possible to make their stay pleasant. Handsome as he is, I imagine the women are each flashing on just how pleasant he could make their stay. No, surely I exaggerate. Is that what I think instead? Flavia and Aneta bring in a bowl of penne in what looks to Julia like a plain tomato sauce. Instead, it's lively and complex. This is delicious, Julia marvels. How do you make it? Aneta shrugs. It's simple. She always says that.
I add 2 handfuls of herbs and parsley chopped finely, and my own tomato sauce.
Some peperoncino, spicy hot. We grow them and I will give you some. It helps most pastas.
Julia notices that Roberto, husband of Flavia, is devouring his, and she does too. Everyone has advice. Where to buy electronics, gas, which vendors at the Thursday market have the best vegetables, what priest is the least boring. The women are asked where they plan to travel, if they've been to Sicily and Elba. They're warned against Naples, one of my favorite cities, and given numerous recommendations for places to eat in the countryside. What does not come up, as it hasn't ever come up for me either, is who they are, where they come from, what they do. I've never figured out whether my Italian friends are indifferent to my life away from here, or if, as written on early maps, a primitive "there be beasties" mentality exists beyond known territories. It's quite odd. When I leave, it's as though I have dropped off the edge. When I return, everyone's thrilled I'm back, but no one asks a question. Live in the moment? Yes, they do. Flavia helps Leo dismantle the rotisserie and carve. The platter is unceremoniously placed in the middle of the table, and soon the women get the idea. You lean in with your fork and stab the piece you want. Flavia's rosemary potatoes, the bread, and wild salad greens similarly just arrive and casually travel around to everyone. The baby chews an olive. I see Camille staring.
Don't worry. She's loved them for weeks now, and she was born with 3 teeth, the mother says.
Roberto lunges for a sausage. I don't think he's eaten for weeks, Camille laughs. Flavia compliments the wine the women brought, but to me it tastes strangely metallic. I may be coming down with something. I'm usually ravenous, especially at this table, but tonight I feel abstemious and unattracted to the savory meats. Susan reaches for seconds.
Now the apricot crostata, my own pear tart, the bitter little glasses of digestivi, Leo drinks only grappa, and the fire burned down to coals.
That is one of the best meals of my life, Camille says. She's had her back to the fire all night and is about to melt. Rather late for a hot flash.
Colin must be late. Poor babe. He'll be stuck with some leftover lasagna.
Una bella cena.
I start the goodbye kissing rounds. That was a beautiful dinner? Camille repeats.
Una bella cena, Leo, Agneta, Flavia.
The four of us walk out together. Agneta calls and runs to them with a jar of her hot pepper flakes.
We are lucky to have them as neighbors, Julia says. Do they know that their food is better than any multi-starred restaurant in the U.S.?
I suddenly feel elated that the women are among us. Each one has the spark of curiosity. I remember well that heightened sense of arrival. In many ways, I still have it. They all three speak with southern accents, but Julia's is the melodious, English-tinged, coastal Georgia one. I would like for her to sit by my bed and read to me. Susan, I recognize as a straightforward person. She'll get a lot done. Camille, my impression is that she's the most protean at this moment, ready to change whatever needs changing. They're nothing like Margaret.
Yes, the Bianchis. They're the best of the best. But you'll find that the everyday food here knocks you sideways all the time. The standard is impossible to grasp unless you live here.
I didn't catch your last name, Kit, Camille says. And do you work here? How long have you been here? Gianni says you are a writer.
Rain. I'm from Coral Gables, but I've been here 12 years.
Seems like forever. Julia shines her flashlight in front of their feet.
Kit Rain.
Oh, I read a book you wrote on Freya Stark, she remembers.
It was on the shelf at Hughes, she explains to Camille and Susan.
I loved it. I'm amazed. I'm always amazed when someone reads anything I write.
That's so cool to hear.
No, I just work at my desk, nothing else, though I do some research for Colin. I think I fell for him because I always wanted to be an architect myself.
Just in a nutshell, before I came here, I taught at UC Santa Cruz, catching waves, as I now think of that year. Then I got a full-time job at the University of Colorado, but I had to quit. I spent 4 years taking care of my mother in Coral Gables. She had MS, then melanoma. I taught part-time and tried to convince myself to marry my high school love. After she died, way too young, I made my great Houdini escape to Italy. This place has given me the big blank space to write, plus an exciting fallback when I'm looking for diversion. No car parked on the road. Colin must be delayed along the way.
You'll have to meet my partner, Colin. I explained that he works here at home and in London, always juggling luggage and plane tickets.
What a life. And you're still young. And gorgeous, I might add.
Susan, you're a principessa to say so.
I'm 44. But I'm one of those old souls. I've always been 44.
Only a week. Julia, Camille, Susan, all settled in well and happily after a week. The three bought down duvets at IKEA and replaced Grazia's heirloom coverlets. They brought home wine glasses, new shower curtains, spatulas, bath mats, and a soft dog bed for Archie. They forgot to look for towels better than the skimpy new ones in their bathrooms. No one wanted to go back to IKEA's vast parking lot and endless aisles. Camille found it annoying to be there at all, though Gianni insisted it was the only place to stock up on practical items. Camille thought it was depressing that someone could furnish an entire apartment in an afternoon and have a pleasant place with absolutely no dimension at all. At the Saturday antique market, Susan found romantic crystal sconces, 20 euros, for her bedside. Camille spotted a brass library lamp with sufficient wattage. Julia moved a marble pedestal lamp from the back hall chest to her room. Julia chose placemats in town, and Camille selected a couple of soft throws for reading by the fire. Susan began to keep flowers on the kitchen table and on the broad stone sill in a living room window. They equipped each bath with a small space heater to take off the morning chill. The villa's thermostat must be pre-programmed, but they haven't yet figured out how to override the settings. Heat goes off totally at midnight and back on at 6. Not fast enough to warm up the house by the time they get up. Wi-Fi works better than at home in North Carolina. But somehow the phones, with new chips Gianni bought, have low signals. Only messages marked Tim come through.
Who is this Tim who keeps calling? Camille wonders.
We don't know any Tim, Julia agrees.
When Gianni explains that Tim is not a strange man, but Telecom Italia Mobile, they startle him as they whoop with laughter, get caught up with it, and can't stop. Uncontrolled laughter, the kind that hurts, catapults them to the next stage.
The one where they fully realize how little they know and how much they want to find out. The delivery of the blue Cinquecento feels like a milestone. Wheels. Grazia adds the car price and insurance to their lease and retains the ownership papers.
This way is yours. I hold it for you until you are residents, she explains.
The women don't fully understand, but go with it. Though the back seat requires contortion, the front is roomy. Being the smallest, Julia isn't happy about her fate to fold into the rear. Susan already has admired the Italian driving skills and is anxious to practice. As soon as Gianni and his cousin deliver the car, she takes off.
Where are you going? Camille calls out to her.
I'll try to find that nursery we passed. Hyacinths and crocuses would look pretty along the drive. I wonder if anemones will grow. I've never had luck with them.
She grinds the gears, backs into the turnaround, and shoots up the hill.
She opens the ragtop just as Louisa did in all kinds of weather. Julia studies her new cookbook, The Science of Cooking and the Art of Eating Well, a classic by Pellegrino Artusi. Since it was published in 1891, she thought it would be only a launching pad for her, the recipes antiquated and calling for many ingredients no longer available. From her publishing job, she's familiar with metric measures in the kitchen, but they by no means are second nature, as are ounces and cups. He's casual anyway about measuring. Pugno, she reads. A handful. Quanto basto? Just enough. Nice. As she laboriously translates recipes for ragù, risotto, ravioli, she realizes how much of the traditional cuisine carries over intact. Except nowhere does she find a recipe for pasta. Artusi assumed everyone knows that. She bought a Lorenzo de' Medici cookbook, too, and tags every other page. So simple. The ricotta crostini, even the ossobuco. Julia hits on the idea of keeping a good log of what she cooks. Then she wonders if she could tie her cooking adventures to her learning of Italian. She has a flash. A book published by Mulberry Press, Learning Italian. Oh, brilliant! This would double the fun of learning both. About everything served at the table, there must be a story, an anecdote, something to learn, and obviously new words. This morning, Camille sets up a place to paint in the room opposite hers. By rearranging the day beds and cane chairs, she clears a spacious corner where she shoves a desk under the window. Gianni is bringing a rectangle of wood 2 feet longer than the desk. He'll help her cover it in canvas and place it over a layer of felt on the top of the desk. This will protect the tooled leather insert, as well as give her a good work surface. She longs for the light of the glass-fronted limonaia, but that will have to wait until spring. She plans to start with still lifes, maybe a la Giorgio Morandi. She's found a book on him in one of the bookcases, along with a 2-volume set on the history of frescoes and a stack of paperback art books on Tiziano, Pontormo, Sassetta, and Bronzino. She could, she realizes, study just that bundle all year. Pontormo's favorite color, and hers, an icy apricot. He favored mauve, ash, washed-out blue, but also aqua and plum. Bronzino, such stark clarity. Tiziano, those heartbreaking, immortal faces. Sassetta, how he cleverly worked landscapes into the backgrounds of the religious subject matter. She pores over the Morandi paintings. Bottles, bowls, pitchers, essential shapes,
pared into abstraction. Even his landscapes were all about volume. If she painted as many repeats as he did of the same chalky-colored cylinders, she'd go crazy. Same with Cézanne and those endless Mont-Sainte-Victoire landscapes. Start simply. 3 kumquats on a blue plate. Even that isn't simple. Not if you want to capture in paint the essence of kumquats. Something like that scented mist they emit from the skin when zested. On a small table raided from the pantry, she arranges her supplies. When will she pick up a brush, uncap a tube of zinc white, and begin? Julia leaves a note on the kitchen table. Walking into town and will stay through lunch. She tucks her camera and her thick 5-subject notebook into her bag. Off to see the wizard, she used to say to Lizzie. Alive, somewhere, Lizzie. Probably fuzzy and sick and full of blame. Wade. 4 in the morning in Savannah, and where does he lay his head? No, no, not now, she said, to the surging memory of his solid, comforting presence in the bed beside her, his even-breathing self. She forced his silhouette onto a view of blue hills, whose undulations resembled the contours of a sleeping man under rumpled sheets. A stooped woman in one of those print house dresses, or are they some kind of wraparound apron, straddles a ditch and parts the weeds. Julia looks at the weedy plants piled on newspaper at her feet. Buongiorno, she calls, startling the woman. Mangia questa insalata? You eat this salad? She manages.
Sì, la nostra insalata del campo.
Our field lettuces, but Julia understands nothing after that. The woman holds up a curly handful she's just cut, then tosses it onto the paper. From her basket, she takes a porcini mushroom as large as a fried egg and offers it to Julia. Crudo is part of what she says. Raw. Only parmigiano and oil. Julia gets this. She's exhilarated to have her first conversation in Italian. Sono Julia. I'm Julia. She extends her hand. Abito. She couldn't think of what to say after I live, so she pointed behind her. Villa Assunta.
La casa di Luisa, the woman says.
Her smile reveals gaps where incisors should be.
Sono Patrizia.
She points to a square smudge of house down below in the valley. Julia assumes she's saying that they're neighbors.
Grazie, Patrizia. Ciao.
She does not yet know that one doesn't just say ciao to someone you've just met.
Arrivederla,
Patrizia responds formally. Julia folds a tissue around the prized porcini and carefully places it in her bag. A raw salad of shaved porcini sprinkled with olive oil and parmigiano. How simple can food get? In town, she stares at stone crests above doors, slashes of light down the alleyway streets, the row of slender marble columns on a long balcony, a glimpse of a frescoed ceiling in an upstairs apartment, a boy who stepped out of a Piero della Francesca painting. If she stays a dozen years, she still will see something new every time she enters San Rocco. She reads all the posted menus and takes a few notes. Ribollita, pollo al diavolo, stinco di manzo, zolfini. The Trattoria Donizetti's door flies open, and she sees a chef eating his early lunch with the staff. She would like to join them. A waiter steps outside to smoke. At the pastry shop, she admires the woven tops of the fruit crostatas like anetas
What a skill with dough. Although she didn't like them very much. Such a difference. American pies are piled with sweetened fruit, whereas these favorites are just a rather thin layer of fruit jam. She selects some raisin pastries for tomorrow's breakfast. Then, at Anna's, buys artichokes, just arrived from Sicily. Macelleria, butcher shop. She steps in and gasps. An enormous cow, stripped of hide, hangs from a chain in the ceiling. A paper towel on the floor catches the last drops of blood. A small crowd seems to be admiring the haunches. Covering her mouth and nose, discreetly, she hopes, she turns to the glass cases. As she catches the butcher's eye, he laughs and winks, recognizing immediately the American's squeamish reaction to his prize from the Chianina beef auction. Julia bites her lip and tries not to turn away from the lolling head of a rooster and his flopping red comb. She manages to order 3 thick veal chops. At the dollhouse-sized grocery, she stocks up on supplies and asks for delivery. They can take home her veal, her prized porcini, and pastries, too. Dinner is shaping up nicely. But it's time for lunch now, and she returns to Stefano's trattoria. An American man stands by a table of 6 women. Stefano pours wine as the American explains the varietal to upturned faces. Everyone tastes. Stefano seats Julia at the next table and recommends the ribollita his aunt is serving forth today. A soup that gives you the energy to climb Mount Amiata. And let me introduce your fellow countryman. He is Chris Burns. And these are his ladies on the tour of food and wine. He brings them always to my crazy father's trattoria to taste la cucina casalinga, the home cooking. Chris, this signora is La Giulia. She has come to live here. They begin to chat, everyone half-turned in their seats. They're from Northern California, traveling for 2 weeks with Chris, a winemaker who takes special clients on in-depth tasting trips twice a year. San Rocco is one of their stops because of the local Syrah, and because Chris and Stefano struck up a friendship at a wine fair a couple of years ago. I don't want to interrupt your tasting. Great to meet you. She reaches for her notebook, ready for a lovely solitary lunch. Don't eat alone. Pull your chair over here, Chris says. Stefano can shift us over. She does. She sits between Lucy, who owns pizza restaurants in Marin, and Alicia, who, with her husband, owns a chain of San Francisco wine stores. Stefano brings out chicken liver crostini and a platter of fried porcini. Chris pours her a glass of what they're tasting. This is juicy. He holds a big gulp in his mouth and rotates his head in circles. Only 1 year in oak. Julia thinks he'll go on about how the wine was produced, but he says instead, "Reminds me of the purple velvet dress my high school girlfriend wore to the prom. Just luscious. Nothing has ever been more luscious than that dress until now." The women laugh. Julia takes a long taste and says, "Well, it reminds me of a bowl of hot grapes in the sun when I first kissed my college boyfriend." They all touch glasses just as the 1 o'clock bell strikes. She tells them what Paolino taught her about the nanny goat bell. Her soup arrives with their potato and speck ravioli that Chris has paired with the wine. He spears one of his onto her bread plate. They talk food. Just in from Florence, they have many recommendations, so many that Julia grabs her notebook. "I am dying to get to Florence," she tells them. Then she shares the story, in brief,
of how she and two friends upturned their lives and came here to learn Italian, eat, explore, and figure out what shape the future should take. Chris listens intently. Julia thinks, he's cute.
Cute?
Is she reverting to the high school proms? But he is attractive. Not in an obvious tall golden god way like Wade, but full of life. He insists that she share their braised quail with juniper berries. He hops up to open his second offering, a 100% Sangiovese. Blood of Jove, that's what Sangiovese means. The Roman god. Yes, that old. Back down to the most ancient roots. The Tuscans have preferred this wine since then. She notices his hands, too. Well-formed, nails cut straight, and a firm grip on the bottle. He pauses every other bite to say, oh, this is good. This is so good. His blunt-cut, tawny brown hair keeps falling across his forehead. His face seems sculpted, all angles that complement each other. Ears. Why am I noticing his ears? Usually they're ugly and primitive, but he has such neat ones, small cockle shells against his head. I'm a southern girl, she says, and I know quail. I was raised on smothered quail. And this is the best I've ever tasted. Stefano is passing around the platter. 3 hours in the slow oven, until they're almost, but not quite, falling apart. And you have the juniper, olives, thyme, and, for goodness, the Vin Santo. Chris is delighted that he mentions Vin Santo. One of the great ones is made nearby, and he plans to offer it with the fig and walnut tart for dessert. Just a taste. There is much to do this afternoon. A few kilometers out in the country, Susan sees a sign for Borgo Santa Catarina. Since all the roads are intriguing, she turns down a stone wall-lined lane barely wide enough for the Cinquecento. If she meets a car, someone must back up. She follows a sign pointing down an unpaved road. Soon she curves into a pebble drive lined with massive lemon trees in pots. Surely one of the Medicis lived here. Flat and unadorned, the peachy stucco facade of the immense villa must be half a city block long. A discreet sign. Hotel Santa Catarina. Curious to see inside, she stops for lunch. This has to be the seat of an aristocratic family from the 1300s. Massive chestnut madia and armadi line a vast room whose windows are swagged and draped in crimson brocade. The walls hung with tapestries and brooding paintings of robust, half-naked women, putti, and horses. A slender Italian, what a shiny gray suit, leads her into a dining room with arched glass doors along one side of a former limonaia. The place could be nowhere but Italy. Shiny suit comes over and offers a glass of Prosecco. Luca, he introduces himself. Susan sees that the suit isn't really mafioso. It's beautifully cut and top-stitched, obviously bespoke. She likes the pocket handkerchief of orange silk. One bite of the pasta with duck sauce, and even a novice knows an Italian is in the kitchen. She declines a secondo and asks for a salad. Susan looks out at the garden, where roses trained on iron hoops along a wall frame views of distant volcanoes and the broad valley. A few yellow buds still bloom. Is that mermaid? Such a vigorous climber, thorns sharp enough for Christ's crown, with flat flowers, the color of lemon juice. She's fascinated by the lack of grass in Italian gardens. It's such a staple in southern yards. And there are no foundation plants. The building firmly meets the ground, where a narrow sidewalk rings the house.
Marciapiedi, Luca explains.
March of feet? Drainage away from the building, she supposes. After lunch, Luca opens a door and gestures to the garden, pool, and spa.
The hotel is my domain. All this belongs to the inspiration of my wife, Gilda. You may find her in the spa or the cooking school right beyond.
You're the owner? My compliments. It's a fantasy of Italy here. Do I have to wake up?
He comments that tourist season is ending, and is she traveling alone?
Susan tells him about Villa Assunta, which he knows, having gone to school with Grazia.
Please, bring your friends. You are always welcome. Take a look around. My family has been here from many centuries. We would like to escape and go to Brazil or some islands, but we must stay always.
Susan laughs. You know, the grass is always greener, she says. But he looks puzzled.
Maybe because there's no grass.
Eva and Caroline will love this when they visit, especially the thermal pool paved with shiny tessellated mosaic. They'd be sparkling all over. She could pass on the red wine bath in a copper tub and the hot gel massage tables, but even in late October, the outdoor pool that you wade into gradually as into a pond looks inviting. She almost sees Eva in her raspberry bikini and Caroline in a bright cover-up, hiding her extra 10, well, maybe 20 pounds, as they step into the water. She buttons her jacket against a wicked wind shooting through the olive grove. Sprung from everything known, she thought. How shocking to be out in the world on my own. Even sprung from the dragging heaviness of Aaron, who seemed not as dead now, more of a companionable memory. She could think now of how Aaron would love the duck. He'd use the word unctuous. He'd want to buy the girls bracelets and shoes in San Rocco. He'd want to walk all the labyrinthine streets at night. He was no longer the confused face looking at her with accusing eyes. He was all his ages again, from the long-haired protester against Vietnam to the terrified new father leaning over Eva as she was bundled up and taken from the orphanage to the taxi, to the suave business owner cinching a contract. How strange that we are feeling this comfortable, she muses. As though we just stepped in a boat and found the current moving us gently along.
Ciao. I'm just saying hello.
Susan steps inside the stone building marked La Cucina Santa Caterina. Luca's wife, Gilda, and an assistant scrub a marble work table. Broth simmers on the back hob of an 8-burner blue stove. She introduces herself.
I just had a delicious lunch and Luca said I should take a tour.
Gilda, small and slender like Luca, has a narrow face and russet hair combed straight back, giving her the look of a benign fox in a storybook.
We are just preparing for an American group coming in today.
She gestures to the stack of lamb chops and a mound of tough-looking greens. The assistant slides a tray of focaccia out of the oven. Gilda offers an espresso, and Susan is tempted to stay, but surely it would be an imposition. Instead, she asks if the school is open to non-guests.
We can always arrange something, Gilda smiles.
Yes, Susan thinks. It's Italy.
I'm beginning to understand. That's the motto.
As Susan searches for her keys, a Mercedes minibus pulls into the parking area and a group of women tumble